From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Last week, President Obama signed a $410 billion spending bill that adds to the ongoing debate over the best way to cure the nation's economic crisis. It will contribute to a projected record deficit of $1.7 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Congress is grappling with it and the so-called earmarks that are a long-standing part of the way the federal government spends taxpayer dollars. All this as the president has also promised to balance the budget. For a closer examination, we have our two economics contributors, Keith Reed, who blogs at keithreedsmoneycorner.com, and author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. Keith, Dr. Malveaux, nice to have you both.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Let's start with this. How different would you say, both of you, and I'll start with you, Dr. Malveaux, how different are President Obama's economic policies from those of the former President Bush, and how much of Obama's direction can be directly attributed to the economic crisis?
Well, prior to our economic downturn, that was made very visible by former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's little three-page memo in September, President Obama, then candidate Obama, had been clear that he did favor more government involvement in the economy than Mr. Bush ever did. Indeed, I think that one of the reasons the American people turned to President Obama was because of the ways that he felt government could make a difference in the outcomes that the economy was delivering. Mr. Bush, on the other hand, was very hands-off. His middle name was tax cut. The word poor never escaped his lips. And he really looked at, if you give people money, they'll make good decisions. Well, that may well be true, but the fact is many people have decided that there are some things they want government to provide, that there are things like public services. So I think you've got the very typical dichotomy between Democratic and Republican approaches to the economy. Democrats tend to want a more activist government. Republicans tend to want the government to be more hands-off. And the differences between Mr. Bush and President Obama can certainly be encapsulated that way. But to fast forward it, this economic exigency has made it all the more important that President Obama move very quickly. Very few presidents have been able to move successfully this quickly. Legislation is frequently proposed, but often not approved in such a short time.
Well, Keith, let me ask you, from a standpoint of the new president, was the economic crisis an opportunity to act or an obligation to act?
It was both. I think if you heard Rahm Emanuel's oft-quoted comment earlier this week that you never waste a crisis, and people have been beating the Obama administration up all week about this. But, you know, to be honest, it was both opportunity and obligation. Of course, as the president of the United States at a time of crisis, you do absolutely positively have the obligation and a responsibility to your constituency, the American people, to take some action, and whether that's in an instance of national defense or whether that's in an instance of economic tumult, you've got to do that. President Obama had no choice but to take swift action, and whether or not you agree on the action that he's taken is immaterial to the fact that he really had no choice but to do something about what's going on in the economy. In terms of it being an opportunity, I mean, listen, you know, the Bush administration, many people on the right, many people in general have forgotten in this conversation over what Obama's doing, that the Bush administration used 9/11 as the opportunity to advance its priorities on national security, on homeland security, on what many people consider to be, you know, government secrecy, you know, those sorts of things. There are many things that happen in the economic world, in the political world, in our daily lives that give presidents the opportunity to advance some part of their agenda. They become, you know, world events or national events become the trigger for some piece of legislation or some broader priority. In this instance, the Obama administration had the opportunity coming in to expend some of its political capital on some of the things that he always said that he wanted to do. Reforming healthcare is one of those things. You know, President Obama has always said that he believed that fixing that the long-term strength of the American economy was tied to what's happening with health care and decreasing costs to individuals and increasing the number of people that have health care coverage. With the economic crisis, it should be no surprise that he's using some of his political capital to advance that agenda.
You know, this is going to be our last segment together doing the economics that we do generally on every Monday as our show comes to an end after this week. So I'd like to ask both of you as economists to talk a little more personally with us about some things. Since our show targets an African-American audience largely, do you think that they are paying close attention to what's going on in the economy, Dr. Melville?
You know, Tony, I'm going to miss News and Notes. One of the things I've enjoyed so much about it has been the way that we've been able to take some time, you know, a good 10 minutes on most of our Monday shows to put some teeth into the way these macro stories hit our community. The majority media really doesn't pay attention to that. Let me give you an example. Last week, of course, we got the numbers that the unemployment rate was 8.1% overall, which, of course, meant about 13% for African Americans. And if you looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics report, you found that the adjusted unemployment rate, including those who were part-time and, you know, want to be full-time and those who dropped out, looked something more like 15.5%. Well, do you know what that number is for African Americans?
No.
I sat down and calculated 24.4%. What that means is one in four African American people who wants to work doesn't have a job. These are depression level rates. Well, once I calculated it for something, a talk I was doing, and talked about it, and then went around to just try to figure out who talks about this. Well, the only place I knew that I would get an open ear was News and Notes. So where are we going to talk about those kinds of things? The fact is that our community needs to pay more attention. We need to demand better news. We not only need to talk about how all these things, the stimulus package, the new budget affect our communities. We need to be activists because while President Obama certainly has put forward a somewhat progressive agenda, the African-American agenda will not be met unless we make demands. There are a whole set of things. We can talk about the way the economy has skewed the ways that we live, especially in the past year or so. One in four people out of work certainly is a skewing. And, you know, as the president of Bennett College for Women, you know, that oasis where we educate and celebrate women, I see parents who've gone bankrupt, parents who've lost jobs and are now struggling with how they deal with issues of tuition and other things, dreams and hopes they had for their daughters that they're now not going to be able to deal with. But part of the challenge that we must also deal with is that of financial literacy, what we can do even in a bad economy to make sure that we're better off than we have to be.
What about that financial literacy within the black community, Keith Reed? How would you describe it? Good, bad, what?
I think it's lacking. And I think that is, or I know that's one of the reasons why I love doing News and Notes. I dare say that a hallmark or one of the most important things in my career as a business reporter has been that I've been very interested in writing specifically when I had the opportunity about financial literacy and about broader economic topics as they relate to the African American community. It is absolutely an imperative that in our community, where so many of the economic trends just have a greater and unfortunately a more negative or at times a more devastating impact, that we have to discuss these issues. I make it a point to, whenever I'm asked by a group especially to speak to an African-American audience about the economy or about a story that I've written or about financial literacy, I've done it. I've blogged about financial literacy and economic topics for the African-American community. This is just not something that we can afford to miss. I want to take a step back, if I can, and talk about what's going on just in business journalism right now. There was a topic on a listserv of journalists just this morning about this back and forth going on between CNBC and Jon Stewart on Comedy Central, and someone asked the question of, you know, whether journalists, whether business journalists, were being held to full account about what happened. And the point that I made when I posted to my response was that, you know, to a certain extent, I believe on business desks across the country, we could have been, I don't know that any of us could have seen what was coming, because some of the, you know, much of what happened in the economy with these derivative schemes and credit default swaps was just unforeseeable. There's no way any journalist or most journalists could have seen this coming. But I do believe, and it's been my experience, that having some diversity of voice in talking about the subject will make you more skeptical. I mean, you know, I've lived in lower income neighborhoods for a lot of my life. I lived in majority African American neighborhoods for a lot of my life, and I know that the people who I grew up with and who have had that experience looked at much of what was happening in this economy. You know, where people were running out and buying big houses, and they were saying, these bank, you know, I remember my mother saying to me, these bankers are swindlers. I remember in 1990 or 1987 or whenever it was when I bought my house that they tried to get me into one of these funny loans, and I told them no, and they thought I was stupid because I was black, and she got, you know, bobbing and weaving with hers.
I understand.
But
you know, let me just jump in and correct you for a moment about those business journalists who didn't see it. Maybe I'm not a business journalist, but I've been calling this one for about 10 years.
A number of you did. Let me just say our time has run out. And you know what I find interesting, and first of all, I want to thank both of you for participating in making our economic segment what it was. We've spent as a community a number of years trying to integrate as far as voting is concerned, getting equal rights there, housing, education. There has not been as much attention paid to trying to level the playing field when it comes to the economy and understanding dollars and having literacy in the black community. And both of you have contributed to that. And we want to thank you on behalf of News and Notes. And it's been a pleasure. We will see you again.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the work you've done, Tony. It has been a delight working with you.
My pleasure. That was author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She is also the president of Bennett College for Women in Greensboro, North Carolina. And Keith Reed has been our regular economics contributor. You can find more of his financial wisdom online at KeithReedsMoneyCorner.com. He joined us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. In this final week of our show, we are featuring thoughts and remembrances from some of our News and Notes contributors. Take a listen.
This is Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, the House Majority Whip. I've always enjoyed News and Notes, and I always saw them as a reference for those issues of real importance to my constituents and the communities that I serve.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The economic meltdown has Americans paying closer attention to their finances. Are African Americans taking note? Plus, is the Democratic Party taking black-owned media for granted in the state of Florida? And today marks the end of our Monday's Bloggers Roundtable. Our regular contributors offer reflections on their time here at News and Notes. So joining me now is Chris Rabb, the founder and chief evangelist of Afro Netizen, founded in 1999. He is currently a fellow at the progressive think tank Demos. You can check out his blog at bloggingwhileblack.com. Jasmine Canick, who blogs at jasminecanick.com, and Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics Blog. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Tony.
Howdy.
Let's talk about this. Jasmine, I'm going to come to you first. Black communities across the country, and this is a follow-up to the conversation I just had with Keith Reed and Dr. Julianne Malveaux about economic literacy. Black communities across the country often turn to check cashing places and not banks. Our phone cards are often pay-as-you-go and not multi-year plans. In other words, a lower-income economy has largely defined the way poorer folks operate. Now, these folks already have a sort of financial literacy, but is it sufficient when we're in the type of national meltdown that we're in?
That's a very, very interesting question. You know, I was driving around Compton not too long ago, and we were counting the number of check cashing places versus banks. And it's almost to the point where the ratio is the same as it is for liquor stores, churches, and motels. And I think that says a lot. I mean, obviously, the country is in an economic crisis right now. But if you look at the news and you look at who the focus is on, it's on middle class America. The people we're talking about right now are not middle class America. So I think that they've already been there. I don't necessarily know if the crisis is affecting them as much as it is affecting sort of the quote-unquote middle-class America, folks that we tend to be more focused on. So do they need to be financially literate, you know, and all in terms of you know, getting the bank account versus, you know, using the check-in place? Obviously, that would be a good thing for them to do, but I don't think that it's feasible when you're talking about a population of people who, A, get paid once a month and have to figure out a way to stretch that money from, you know, the first, second, third, or fourth when they get it to the next time it goes around, and B, when you're talking about communities where even within their own communities, they don't make it accessible for them to get that literacy. They don't get that information. I mean, instead of bringing in banks into the community, we have city councils and politicians who are catering to businesses like check cashing and payday loans, and we'd rather have those in the community.
Well, let me ask you, Charles, how can people who are in the lower rung move up out of that and into the middle class if they don't become more knowledgeable about the financial situation and the economy as a whole?
Well, it's about financial literacy. Obviously, you know, I call those type of payday loan folks, those are short-term issues for folk who are living literally paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. But I think we live in a duality, if you will. Those folks who have or had jobs were looking to move up. Those are the folks who got caught up in those mortgage deals that sounded too good to be true. In other words, you wanted to get out the apartment, so somebody told you you could have a house for $300 that's worth $500,000, and you said, "Okay, that sounds like a cool deal." And then, of course, you couldn't pay that little bit of money that you thought because your mortgage rate adjusted. And I think part of this financial literacy that needs to happen is that look how much money they're taking out of your little bit of check. But the bottom line is that, you know, banks all over the country are not establishing themselves in communities, period. I mean, I think there's a shrinkage going on where you literally got to drive 4 to 5 miles just to get to a bank. I mean, think about it, the number of ATMs that are in the inner city versus the suburban areas.
Well, that's an interesting point. And many of the ATMs that are in the inner city are in 7-Elevens and places like that where they charge you a lot to use them. But Chris, the credit crisis, though, it does affect these people even on the bottom rung, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it impacts all Americans. Obviously, those with the least amount of income are impacted the most because they have fewer options. Just like Jasmine was saying earlier, they got one paycheck a month and they're trying to stretch it as far as they can. But, you know, the other thing that we really have to talk about whenever we talk about black folk and money is wealth. And so we should really be talking about wealth literacy, because if you don't understand the difference between wealth and income, it doesn't matter whether you're in a bank or you're in a predatory lending operation. The reality is, even those of us who consider ourselves middle class, which is a very vague socioeconomic stratum, we don't have any wealth. We don't have any assets. For many of us, our house is our biggest asset, and our mortgage is more expensive than the value of our home, right? We don't inherit the same amount. In fact, we have 1/12 of the wealth of our white counterparts. 1/12, not half, but 1/12. When you control for class, quote unquote class, the disparity between whites and blacks based on wealth is ridiculous. But the fact of the matter is, mainstream media doesn't talk about it. Our black organizations don't talk about it with the consistency and depth that they need to, and we're not educating ourselves as much as we should. But, you know, we use the internet differently than other demographic groups. So when black folks surf, we overwhelmingly use it for education, health, and employment, and also news. You know, so that means we need to make sure that we have more independent black media.
That's an interesting point, Tony, that you make. Let me just ask you this before we move on, Charles, because I want to follow up on something that Chris mentioned, and that is, well, we talked about the lower economic class, but there are a lot of black folks who are in the middle class who themselves are not necessarily as financially literate as they should be. If you agree, say so, Charles, and then make your point.
Yes, I agree with that. But the thing is that black folks have been dealing with recessions for a long time. You know, White folks just found out it was a recession. Black folks known it was a recession for a long time. And they've been dealing with it. So they've been cutting back. So they didn't buy the Lexuses go around, nor did they go out and, you know, spend their money. Those are the folks who are hoarding their money because they know that tough times are going to be around the corner. And they're not just going out and spending frivolously. They look at the fact that their friends are losing their jobs. And they say, am I next?
All right. I tell you what, let's move on to another topic just because that was a good one and we could talk about it the whole time. But there are some other ones that are also important that I want us to spend some time on, this being our last time together. Jasmine, I'm going to come to you on this one because the California Supreme Court heard arguments earlier this month on the constitutionality of Prop 8, the initiative that overturned the legal same-sex marriage here in California. The court will issue a ruling by early June. But this has been a particularly divisive issue in the black community. I don't have to tell any of you. I actually saw, Jasmine, a Yes on 8 poster in a neighborhood window the other day, not far from where I live. How likely are we to see the court overturning Prop 8, do you think?
That's a good question, too. And yes, I still see Yes on 8 signs and No on 8 signs in my neighborhood as well. And I live in one of those neighborhoods that's still black right now. I think anytime you have a decision that's overturned by the people, there's always that chance that the court, because again, this, you understand the context, this was one decision that a group of people decided they didn't like, so they put the proposition on the ballot, basically overturning what the original decision was. So I'm under the belief that the court's going to come back and say, hey, we're going to go back to what we said originally, and it will be proven that it's unconstitutional. Could happen, could not happen. What I know for sure is that what happened November 4th can't happen again, and that they have a lot of work to do, and they, meaning the gay community, and a lot of times I separate myself because I am a lesbian, but I'm a black lesbian, which holds a different distinction all of its own. Mm-hmm. And so the white gay community has a lot of work that they need to do because they went a little buck wild with it.
go ahead, Charles. Let me just say, for people who are tuning in, this is the Roundtable. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We are talking with Chris Rabb, founder and chief evangelist of AfroNetizen. We are also talking with Jasmine Canick, who blogs at jasminecanick.com, and Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog. All right, Charles, take it away.
Very simply. We here back on the East Coast, so keep wondering, is this California? We thought you got about free love, you know, gay marriage. We are just having a difficult time figuring out why black folk don't like gay people. Because we know in the church, you know, I'm not going to suggest that the musical minister is gay, but we know he's a little bit flamboyant. We don't understand why y'all got a problem with that.
Who are you referring to, Charles?
Yeah, Charles.
Well, I'm suggesting that in most black churches, and you correct me if I'm wrong, the musical minister is a tad bit flamboyant.
Or the pastor, not just the choir, not just the choir director, but I give you an amen, amen.
All right, so
I know we're trying to figure out, well, wait a minute, we heard that California was one of the most progressive states in the country, but black folks don't want gay folks.
What you're talking about is an apparent hypocrisy in the black community when you have people associated with the church who are either clearly homosexual or who appear to be and may not have come out. And at the same time, the church turns its back on things like gay marriage. That's the point that you're trying to make?
Absolutely. And you can talk about AIDS. You know, nobody wants to admit there's AIDS going on in the black community. And I think at least some of us on the East Coast are wondering, we thought Californians are a little bit more progressive.
Well, I guess they found out.
You know,
out,
three
didn't
strikes started in California.
Absolutely.
So I don't know how progressive that is.
So, Jasmine, what it sounds like from listening to Charles and to Chris and the conversation that we're having, that there is a long way to go before this fissure can be closed.
Absolutely. And I'm going to do my part here in California to help make sure that we close it. I will let everyone know first that my film is almost done. It's a white gay's guide on how to deal with the black community for dummies. And it is a documentary. And I'm going to help the gay community understand where black people are coming from on this.
All right. You know, we talked more about these two things, and they took up some of the time that we were going to use to talk about the media in Florida. But I want to use the last moments that we have together for this instead, because I think that it's important. We have been doing Bloggers Roundtable for a few years now. And Jasmine, you were one of the very first ones who participated in this here with us at News and Notes. Just briefly, what was it like that first day, and what's been the impact on you from your participation in this?
Well, what I will say is that it was ingenious for News and Notes to include bloggers on their radio program because, to my knowledge, it hadn't been done. And it also created a partnership online that was just a very smart partnership because each of the different bloggers that have been featured have brought their audiences to News and Notes and helped grow that audience. And I mean, from day one up until today, it's been fabulous. It's just been a fabulous experience. And I've heard from people all over the world who tune into News and Notes, and it's truly, truly a loss for the community. And I'm still debating on whether or not I'll be picketing on Monday.
Oh, my.
Chris, I hear you.
I'm not sure how many times you have been a part of the bloggers, but what's been
173.
Wow.
What's been your experience?
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't realize we existed. You know, it's just the fact that News and Notes had the foresight and intelligence, quite frankly, to mm-hmm. Recognize and, you know, validate those of us who are in the Netroots. Because, you know, we often don't even get that attention on the political left in the blogosphere.
Well, you
and
know,
to have it, yeah, really. I mean, I am often a very, very small minority, statistical minority, in a lot of these quote-unquote progressive liberal environments. And it's good to see that there is at least one program that acknowledges what we do and it respects the panoply of voices and perspectives that we represent online and on land. And, you know, that's important. When I first started in 99, there were white folk who were like, wait, you have a computer? there's a level of, you know, lack of exposure and a set of assumptions that made it very difficult to toil it, you know, below the radar before blogging became sexy.
Well, you know what? Let me bring Charles in here to say, there was discussion even here at News and Notes about whether it would be valuable to have bloggers giving just their opinions and whether or not the people who blog are people who have credibility. Do they do their homework? Do they know what the heck they are talking about? But it seems over the years that we have done this, Charles, that it has become clear, like any place else, you have really good bloggers and you have some that are, you know, not so good, but it is not just bloviating opinions.
No, it isn't. In fact, you know, I, at the time, I was writing about a unique niche about black politics in America, and I had met this guy named Barack Obama, and I had no way to get out that I met this guy, and the blog became this kind of my notes on the road. I also met this guy named Michael Steele, and now these are like the political darlings of today. And part of what, you know, I was recently asked about, well, what does your blog try and do? I always said my blog should wow you. In other words, you should say wow at the end of that. And this program gave voice to a lot of folk who were saying things that were going on in communities across the country that needed to be said. Understand that, you know, we're not going to get invited to meet the press or Fox and Friends or anything like that. So our voices were part of a paradigm that will not go away. You know, think about all of the blogs that are out there. As I jokingly say, black blogs are nothing but a black novella that can write about anything and everything. And at the end of the day, you know, we do have something to say. And you're right, not everyone is, you know, doing the homework. But those of us who are doing the homework are glad that we got a chance to tell our stories, not just online, but to a much broader audience.
Well, you know, and that's the good thing I'll say as I bring this to a close and to let all of you know how much we appreciate you and the other bloggers who we have had on. News and Notes was a conduit, I suppose. You could describe it as an opportunity to begin something that, while it is ending in this form, perhaps it will pick up in another form at some point in the future. But on behalf of the staff and everyone here at News and Notes, Jasmine, Chris, Charles, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
That was Chris Rabb from the blog Afro Netizen. He joined us from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog. He joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Jasmine Kanick, who blogs at jazzmancanic.com. She joined us here in the studios of NPR West.
My name is Ron Christie. I'm a former special assistant to President Bush and a contributor on News and Notes for the past 2 years. And I think what News and Notes has done that has been a remarkable achievement to its listening audience is bringing diverse viewpoints together to talk about politics in a collegial yet engaging manner.
The new CD, 1 Ounce of Truth, puts the vivid words of poet and writer Nikki Giovanni to music.
The world is not a pleasant place to be without someone to hold and be held by.
Musical styles like bossa nova, jazz, and a dash of soul are fused with Nikki Giovanni's words. Most of the songs are sung by Kapathia Jenkins. NPR's Tony Cox recently spoke with Nikki Giovanni and Kapathia Jenkins about the project.
Kapathia, let's start with you because you're known for your work on Broadway and shows like Martin Short, Fame Becomes Me, and Caroline or Change, just to name a few, as well as acting in numerous television shows. Why did you decide to make a CD of songs based on poems by Nikki Giovanni?
Well, I've been working with Louis Rosen, who's the composer, and it was actually his idea, and I was on board right away. I mean, she writes so beautifully about love, love lost, love gained, falling in love, and for me, the opportunity to work with Louis and to do my own thing, so to speak. You know, when you're doing Broadway and theater, you're playing characters and all that. And this gave me an opportunity to really show what I do.
Well, Nikki, when you were approached about the project, what did you think? I mean, how did you feel about your work being interpreted in this way?
I have no ear. I mean, I get to sing in the shower if nobody's around. But it was just wonderful when this project was brought to me. I thought, yes, let the singers do it. Louis is always surprised. If he was here, he'd say, Nikki didn't try to give us directions. But I hate people that give you directions when they don't know what they're talking about.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs on the CD. For one, let's talk about Telephone Song. Now, the chorus, that almost sounds like a 1960s sock hop to me a little bit, Kapathia. What's this tune about, and how did you capture it musically? Because it seems like a conversation between two old friends.
Cans and strings and backyard trees. Giggles coming through the wall. Summer mud pies, lemonade stands.
You know, when I was growing up, I had a best friend, and we'd be on the phone after school, and my mom would be telling me to put the phone down, and her mom would be telling her to put the phone down. So we'd say, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Okay, meet me at first period. Okay, all right, bye. And then we go, did you hang up? No, you hang up first. No, you hang up. No, you hang up. And I think Nikki's writing is just so dead on, and it reminds me of my best friend, who's still my best friend to this day.
Really? Well, Nikki, was there a special friend that you were writing about?
Absolutely. Her name is Johnita Fletcher. And we'd be on the phone, and we would talk, and it'd be, hang up. No, you hang up first. I know many a night. That was when the phones.
That is so funny. Your one phone per household.
So you could fall asleep on the phone.
That's,
and phone.
That's really funny. Yeah. What's the story behind another one of the songs? This one is called You Were Gone. There's a line that caught my ear when I first heard it, and it's when you say, you were gone like the years between 25 and 30. Now, I'm old enough to know just what that feels like.
I got to tell you, my favorite line is, you were gone like last week's paycheck for this week's bill.
That's really gone.
I mean, that's being gone. That's
that
gone.
Is gone.
You were gone like last were gone. You were gone like the years between 25 and 30.
Let me ask you, Kapathia, how you and Louis Rosen managed to come up with the sound and the tenor to fit these lovely poems.
Well, I tell you, Louis is absolutely brilliant that way. He just has a knack for, you know, reading a certain poem and feeling like immediately he can set it. With Nikki's stuff, it was so easy for him because I think the writing is so strong in terms of the imagery and just how we sort of talk and conversationally every day. And then coming up with, you know, the actual arrangements and the bass, I love the violin. And so the songs are just really strong. We had a ball doing this project.
Obviously you did. It sounds like you did. A couple of more questions. One for you, Nikki, is this. Mm-hmm. As the music evolved for the words that you had already written, did it change the feel of your poetry to you?
I think it brought it out. You know, it's sort of like cleaning up an old photo. And I don't mean that my poetry was not. I just mean that it brought out something else. One of my favorite that they do is Careful, Baby, Don't Prick Your Finger. And it really, I had heard it on the tune of Careful, Baby, Don't Prick Your Finger. But Kapathia took it to ba-ba-ba-doo-bow. And it stayed with me. I walked out of the club the other day, and I'm just like, yeah. You know? And I love it. I so regret. This is a poem I wrote for Nina Simone. And I so regret that Nina is not here to hear it. Because, again, she did such wonderful work with Warren Cuny, you know, with No Images. You know, she did a lot of tone poems, as did Roberta Flack. And Roberta also was a friend. And she said to me one day, you know, girl, I wish I knew the music in your head. I just thought it was the nicest thing because I don't really do music as Louis and Kapathia do music. But you do hear these sort of rhythms. And I think that they brought it out. It was wonderful.
Yeah, well, you do music. It's just not on a chart. You definitely do
right.
music. You have another song on here that I heard it, and I was like, wait a minute. Am I hearing what I think I'm hearing? You know what song it is? That Day.
I knew you would say that.
I don't know if it's because I'm a man or what, but my ears just perked right up on That Day. How did you put that together?
I know you're not asking me.
Well, no, I'm not asking you that.
This is a family show.
Well, we just love that, you know, this song is seemingly about everything, but really it's about sex. You know, Louis just came up with this catchy tune. And I just thought, you know, I'm just going to sing this like it's about everything else. And then, you know, people are going to realize what it's really about.
If we do it once a month, we can do it in time. If we do it once a week, we can do it in rhyme. If we do it every day, we can do it every way. We can do it like we did when we did it that day. Oh, I know I'm bold coming on like this, but the good things in life are too good to be missed. Now time is money.
Are you going to do this again, the two of you, do you think?
Oh, gosh, I would certainly hope so.
I tell you, Louis has already written, I think, 6 or 7 more Nikki songs. And I was over his place a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, I got to play it for you. He's still so excited about her poetry. So, you know, and he's got some really good ones coming down the pike. So I'm sure we will do this again.
Nikki Giovanni, Kapathia Jenkins, thank you so much. And I really enjoyed talking to both of you.
Thanks, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with poet Nikki Giovanni and singer Kapathia Jenkins about their new CD, 1 Ounce of Truth, the Nikki Giovanni songs.
It'll find me. You get yours and I'll get mine if I learn to sit and wait. When I get to heaven, I'm gonna jump and shout.
In the world of gospel music, no singing group stands taller than the Caravans. The quartet was formed in the early 1950s by Albertina Walker. Walker says she created the Caravans so that she wouldn't have to sing alone. Now more than 50 years later, she boasts the distinction of having launched the solo careers of some of the biggest names in spiritual music, including Shirley Caesar, James Cleveland, and Inez Andrews. The Caravans' final incarnation consisted of Walker, Andrews, Dorothy Norwood, and Dolores Washington. That group disbanded in the 1970s. But this year, the Caravans got together again for a reunion CD. That gave NPR's Tony Cox the perfect opportunity to get them all into the studio here at NPR West. Albertina described how she came up with the name for the group.
If you look back then and look now, how things was, we are the Caravans, because all the singers that sung with me was from somewhere else. That, you know, we was all from different places.
Really?
Alabama, Georgia, Carolina.
The three of you, Dorothy and Inez and Dolores, you joined the group at later times, correct?
Yes.
All right. What was it that made you, starting with you, Dorothy, decide that the Caravans was a place that was a good fit for you?
Well, I decided it when I was in Atlanta, Georgia, but I knew that I couldn't get in the Caravan staying in Georgia, so I got on the train, and when I finished school and I came to Chicago, John Reverend Clay Evans Church, and I sang in the choir so I could be connected with the church. And I always loved Albertina walking the Caravan. That was my greatest goal, to do that. And one Sunday night, she came to the broadcast, and I was leading a song. And when I saw her walk through that door, I pulled out my best stop. I said, uh-oh, this is my shot here. And when service was over, she asked me, you know, did I want to go on the road and sing with the Caravans? I said, yes, ma'am. I started to say, what you think I'm doing way up here? And the rest is history.
Inez, tell us how you got involved with the Caravans.
I came to the Caravans through Reverend James Cleveland. I lived in Birmingham, Alabama, and I had been singing with the Gospel Harmonettes. Reverend Cleveland went back and told Albertina about me, and I went up for an audition, and I'm still auditioning.
Oh, I think you got the job. Dolores, what's your story?
There was a young lady by the name of John Aaron Austin who was the soprano singer, and she was leaving. And so they needed another soprano singer. So they came to Robbins, Illinois, and I auditioned for the group for the soprano part, and I've been with them ever since.
Really? What does it feel like to be singing again with the Caravans after all these years?
I just feel like it's one of the greatest things that could happen in my life.
Really?
At this time.
Why do you say that?
Because I've been through the storm and the rain, and he keeps on bringing me back, and he keeps on blessing me over and over with these same young ladies.
Same young, good-looking ladies too, huh?
You ought to clap your hands and pat your feet. Even though you're walking along the street, if you got it, why don't you
show some sign?
Inez, does the sound seem different? Does it seem the same? How does it feel now compared to before?
I think sometimes we underestimate ourselves, because sometimes I think we sound a little better. But I'm just so grateful that we have this privilege to be able to come together after 40 years. That's a long time. And we are highly blessed, and we owe it all to the Lord.
Let me ask you, Dorothy, because all of you have been successful individually. And to come back, even temporarily, in a group setting means there's a little sacrifice that you have to make. Oh, yes. You know, it's not just one star on the door. There's four or five now.
Yes, that's right.
How much of an adjustment for you was that?
Well, It's an adjustment now, because I handle most of the business and I have my own career still going strong, thank God. But, you know, it was a dream and a vision that the Lord gave me, was to bring these young ladies back together once again. And what can I say? It's been a good ride so far, and I got my seatbelt fast and ready to go up again.
Going where the chilly waters flow,
no more.
Going where the chilly
Now, Albertina, you know, you started it all, and Dorothy sort of brought you all back together again for the reunion. As you look at the Caravans and the role that you played in its development and the role that you still play, what does it mean to you?
Well, it means that the Lord is and was well pleased. It was all about Him. We came out on the road when we started singing. Our mission was to win souls for Christ. Didn't even have a fear or price in our heads to ask people for. And He blessed us. We don't know anything about being hungry because He provided for us. When you're working for Him and you wait on Him, let Him bless you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about nobody, man blessing you, because man will give you a blessing and take it right back. But God will give it to you and you'll keep it. Look how long we've been out here.
I know.
All of
true.
Us 70 years old and more. Isn't that a blessing?
That is a blessing.
And we're still here.
And you feel like God is still giving you voice.
Don't you start me here.
Let me impose upon you. I know that you have to work later on. And I know you have to save those angelic voices for another time. But it would be great if you would just share with us, even briefly, just, I don't know, a phrase, a song.
Lord, keep me day by day.
NPR's Tony Cox with the Caravans. Their reunion CD is called Paved the Way.
And perfect way. Lord, I want to live. I want to live. Lord, let me live. I want to live.
Just can't preach like Paul,
but you can say,
I love the